Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. We're going to be talking with two staff members from Federal News Radio today. And first off is a newcomer to this show, Scott Massioni. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Hey, listen, since you're new kid on the block, as it were, new guy on the beat, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you wound up at Federal News Radio.
Sure. Well, I'm originally from Frederick, Maryland, so part of the D.C. metro area. And I went to the University of Maryland, studied journalism and political science, and then went on to get my master's in political science at American University. And before coming here, I spent about 2 years covering the Pentagon and defense policy, basically, for InsideDefense.com, which is a newsletter, which very wonky newsletter.
Uh-huh.
And then I've been here for about 8 months. And in between, you know, when I was in college and getting my graduate degree, spent some time covering politics and other local news as well back then.
Interesting. I used to go to the Pentagon fairly often, but with the new security now, it's kind of a nightmare to get in, and you need an escort, as you well know, and all that. You get over there a lot?
Sure. Yeah, I get over every once in a while. I have my own Pentagon pass, so I don't have to worry about any of the escorts or anything. But they, you know, they have daily press briefings and everything, and we pop in there whenever they do any personnel issues or anything that has to do with stuff that we cover, federal workers.
Fantastic building in and of itself. My mother was one of the first civilians to work in the Pentagon back during the war. And I know we lived in that vicinity, but there was maybe an urban myth, maybe true, that as big as it is, five sides, five stories and all that, that you can get to any part of the building in like 14 minutes or something like that. Have you heard that?
I have not heard that, but I have definitely walked around, and I don't know if it's true or not, but it's definitely a walk. My moves, which counts how many steps I take, I usually go about a mile whenever I'm walking in the Pentagon.
So. I was reading a book called The Pentagon's Brain, and it's about DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. And just various vignettes about DARPA and whatnot. And they said that at the center court of the Pentagon, which I know you've been to, at one point there was a covered area there, and they said the Russian satellites passing over it were fascinated by how many people were there and what was drawing them and where they went. And they decided that there was a tunnel underground, that there was another Pentagon down there, and that was it. Turns out it was a hot dog stand.
Really?
Yeah, but interesting place. But enough of this frivolity. Defense is changing its appraisal system. Is this sort of like the one they did before, the National Security Personnel System? I mean, is it on that magnitude?
You're probably more familiar with that than I am.
I know about that one. Yeah.
I wasn't too familiar with that one, but I can tell you the new one is definitely changing for the new. It was prompted by Congress. They put it in their NDAA, their National Defense Authorization Act. What it does is it creates a three-tiered rating system for these employees. So every DoD civilian employee is going to have to go through this eventually, but it's coming in a phased way. So you're not going to see it if you're a defense employee. You might not see it for a year or two. But that, you know, they have a small phase one that's starting it now. They just started April 1st. So it's a three tiers rating system. And it's what they want to do is get rid of this, what they call the 365th day. That's, you know, you get your big surprise evaluation on the 1 year mark.
Mm-hmm.
And you had no clue what was going on that whole year before. So they want to check in 2-3 times a year with their supervisors, so their workers are more caught up to what's going on, and, you know, makes them a little more in the know for what is coming, you know, in the next year, in the next few months.
So if the boss hasn't seen you for a year and calls you in, you don't have, maybe you don't have to worry. You should have some sense of where you fit in the scheme of things.
Right. And beforehand, you know, they would only see each other once a year. And
yeah.
And that's a long time to kind of get an update on how you're doing. So they want to close this gap.
Do you get any feedback from managers on this? And I ask because in the past they've tried similar things all over the government. And the managers say it's not that we don't like the idea, but it's too much work.
Right. So I talked to Paige Hinkle-Bowles. She's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Civilian Personnel Policy. And she said that she got a lot of feedback from managers, and they seem to be pretty open to it because these aren't necessarily formal meetings. They can be just kind of a, let's sit down real quick, talk for 5 minutes, just make sure we're all up to speed on everything. And it's not something where they have to formally write down all this paperwork and all that kind of stuff. So they're hoping to make it just a little more of a check-in, a little more personable between people.
Well, now, when you say three tiers, is that like a title? Because at one point, the director of Office of Personnel Management, John Barry, wanted to have a three-tier system, and it was something like journeyman, craftsman, and beginner, something like that. Is anything like that?
No. So this is something, it's basically how you're appraised. So it goes unacceptable to very, you know, successful,
highly
you're doing
successful.
A good job,
uh-huh.
to outstanding.
Okay.
And based on these tiers, there's incentives for you getting possibly a pay upgrade within your grade, and also QSI, so you can also get that. So it's something that not only do you want to go in and make sure you do a good job, but you know, there's incentives behind it. So I think you know, once you get an outstanding for a couple months in a row, they say, okay, look, this might be a good idea. If you put in for a pay raise, we're gonna look at these different ratings that you're getting.
Oh, okay. Now, you say this came out of the House?
This came out of Congress in general.
Okay.
So they're NDAA.
But both controlled by Republicans. And
correct.
In the past, whenever they've done things, I don't want to say, use the editorial word, against or aimed at federal workers, some of them have been pretty harsh. Like I would assume that coming from the Republican side of the Congress, the dominant side, that there's a punitive angle to this too, that like, let's weed out the deadbeats and get rid of them. Any of that?
Right. I wouldn't say there's exactly that. The people, if you get an unacceptable grade, especially for something that's considered critical, you have to go in and meet with your supervisor, and then they give you this kind of written reprimandation, and they say, okay, you have 60 days to clean your act up, make sure things are going to happen, or we're going to transfer you, or it could be grounds for termination. So I guess there is a little bit of that in there. But, you know, there's also the other side, too, where it says, look, if you do a really good job, we're going to look at you for promotions. We're going to look at you for, you know, for pay raises as well.
I just wonder if somebody, say this is fully operational down the road, 2, 3, 4 years, and they check it out and they see that 90% of the people rated excellent or superior, and a lot of them got raises, and only a handful were presumably fired or disciplined. I mean, is that in the works?
Yeah, I guess that'd be a possibility. I wouldn't say that this is something they're putting in necessarily to weed people out, but more as what's called a force of the future. Are you familiar with the force of the future?
No, not really.
So the Defense Department, Ash Carter, who's now the Defense Secretary, he put in what's called the force of the future, and that's a series of reforms for personnel. And what he's trying to do is basically recruit and retain talent in DOD. And so this is kind of seen as part of that, even though it came from Congress, but DOD's really kind of took it and ran with it, and they want to use this as a way to incentivize their employees to do better and to stay within the DOD and not go to, you know, Google or all these other places that are paying so much more money and, you know, have so many more benefits that are better. So this rating system is more of a way to keep people there and know that their hard work is not going unseen.
And now, would people continue to get these within grade raises, that is the longevity step increases?
Yes, they would. And,
okay.
And this is something that would help them get those. You know, they might get them faster or be more qualified to get them, I guess, you know.
Yeah. Well, I would think that people in the very top grades, 14s and 15s, who are already at the top of the ceiling, they can't by law go over that. So I guess they would they might get a good report card, but they wouldn't get any extra money.
Correct. I believe this stops at pay grade 13, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
So it might be just exactly how you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, okay. The last time they tried this, and again, it was a Republican initiative, the National Security Personnel System, I think it was called, was implemented in the Bush administration. Unions hated it from day one, would not participate. And so defense then was forced to make it a tool only for people who weren't covered by a union bargaining unit. So they were a different breed of cat, if you will, from the regular Pentagon employees. And the track record for that, it was pay banding as well, but the track record for that was that most people got bigger raises than they would have under the normal GS system, and they got bigger raises than people in the union-covered jurisdictions would have gotten because they were outside of it. And the unions fought it. Now, what's the union's position this time?
So I'm not exactly positive. I believe since that everyone is going to be under this plan, that there's no union, you know, at least they don't have any agreement that would keep people from going under this review system. But from what I can tell, you know, it seems to be a pretty universally accepted thing. And since it was mandated by Congress, I think that they had everything kind of had to go according to plan, according to law.
Right, you know? Okay. Need to take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm Mike Causey here, and I'm with Scott Massioni. He's covers the Defense Department for Federal News Radio, and a very interesting background. He worked for a very specialized DOD newsletter. He says a wonkish kind of thing, but he's really hit the ground running here at Federal News Radio. Scott, we were talking about this new personnel system, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten what it's called. Does it have a nickname?
It doesn't exactly have one of those specialized acronyms yet, but it's part of what's called the New Beginnings Initiative within DOD. It's the Defense Performance Management and Appraisal Program is the exact one.
Okay. Now, is there any kind of special training going to be required of defense supervisors in order to implement this program? I have a ulterior motive for asking that.
Not that I'm aware of. I spoke with the person, the architect kind of behind this. He spent about 3 years working on it. I think really what they ask is just that they want people to meet with their supervisors more. And I think that's kind of the beauty of it, is they don't want all these people to have to go through training and just add more bureaucracy. It's more of just a face-to-face, this is, you know, human interaction. We know what's going on within the Defense Department, so our supervisors are more informed and the employees are more informed of their expectations.
Okay, because if it was true, it wouldn't be the first time in government that Congress mandated some sort of a program and that the training required could only be supplied by somebody they happen to know, a firm or company. The real winners in all of these things were the people who did the training. So it doesn't seem to be the case in this instance.
Right.
This personnel office at the Defense Department, there's been a bit of a shakeup over there. Do you know what's going on?
That's right. Yeah. So we don't know exactly 100% what's going on. You know, they kind of keep things under wrap there in the Pentagon. But what we've kind of found out and we know for a fact is that there's been six different undersecretaries of personnel and readiness for the past 7 years. So since Obama came into office. That's a lot of turnaround, especially considering these are people that need to be nominated, appointed, and confirmed. The most recent one is Brad Carson. He is just stepped down on April 8th. That was the last Friday. So he had a nomination hearing. I want to say it was probably early April. And he said he was behind this whole Force of the Future, which we talked about earlier. He was the architect of that. And so Congress, you know, some of the Republicans weren't exactly excited about the Force of the Future. They're saying we're spending all this money trying to retain and recruit top talent and be a quote unquote progressive employer when there's readiness that needs to happen. You know, there's money we could spend on modernization, things like that, to keep the troops more protected in war zones, things like that. So Carson got a lot of flack for that, and then he also got some flack from Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma about his tactics as a leader. There were some whistleblower allegations about him having a hostile workplace. So basically, they put a big hold on his, not an exact hold, but they put a semi-hold on Carson's nomination until he could get a... What they wanted was a climate assessment, and that's something they do in the military. So what Carson did instead, he did a SurveyMonkey survey, and things seemed to be all right. But, you know, it didn't look like he was going to make it, so he withdrew his nomination and retired from the post that he was at now. So it looks like they're looking at Peter Levine, who now is in the DCMO position, to take his place.
Hostile work environment. I haven't heard that used officially in a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what the situation was or was alleged to be?
No, so I looked into it. I tried to get Senator Inhofe's office to give us some of those whistleblower allegations. They refused to hand those over. But from what we understand, it seemed that he was kind of pushing his employees too hard. And if you look inside with some other undersecretaries, you know, those deputy undersecretaries and things, a few years ago, there were a couple of them that according to the DODIG, that forced workers to give them rides to the airport for personal, rides, yeah. things like that. So there's some fishy stuff going on, and we're not seeing everything yet. But maybe when the books mm-hmm. come out a couple years from now, we might get a little more light on it.
It seems to me maybe it was in the intelligence community, but there was a situation recently here, obviously in the Washington area, where a high official, and I don't want to slander anybody, but it was one of the intelligence agencies, was going to an intelligence facility in Tyson's Corners, and then from there hitching a ride to his office. So he was leaving his car. He was using one agency as a carpool,
right?
Not a parking lot, rather.
Right.
And he was getting rides and that kind of allegation. That's the kind of thing that gets to people. They do blow the whistle on that, don't they?
Oh yeah, yeah. And this guy, his name was Forrester, and with this IG report. It came out in December 2014, but we didn't get it until recently because of a FOIA request. So he also spent a day at a Nationals game instead of working. So, those are things I'm sure that hardworking government employees get a little ticked off about.
The troops were watching, huh?
Right, okay. Right.
I want to ask you about the fact that this is a lame duck presidency, last year of this administration. An initiative like this, you never know how serious they really are with it, because it's going to take a while to get in place, maybe at least a year. Is it possible that this could be undone in 2017?
There's always a possibility that they won't pick up the stick, when things go on. But I think it being mandated by Congress, not only in one NDAA, but also clarified in a second NDAA, I think by law, they're really going to have to carry this on, or at least implement it to some sort of initial operating capability. But I think this is something that's probably going to benefit everyone. It's hard to say you shouldn't meet with your supervisors more. It seems like something that's really going to benefit the employees, but you never know what these things also. It could be something that goes the other way, a real burden on the supervisors as well.
Did they come up with, or did you see any sort of like cost estimates of this? Because presumably more people will be getting raises, as you said, quality step increases, as well as some other kind of raise. Are they predicting what 40%? 20% will get it? Have you seen anything like that?
Right. No, they haven't done anything like that yet. And I think that's just because they're doing a phased outlook of things. So, there's only a small swath of people that are going to be getting this. And then a couple years out, then maybe they'll have 50% of the DOD. So it might be hard to figure those kind of things out. And then also, since things are based on performance, we don't know necessarily that those increases will actually happen, because if everyone's performing under quality, then there might be less step increases.
Yeah, that was one of the big complaints, starting with the Carter administration, and they call them being there raises, as in the fact that if you stay on the job long enough, you'll get one of those step increases, which are worth 3%. And so even during the pay freeze time, many people have come up and gotten the 3% raises, and there was some criticism in Congress of that virtually everybody gets them. So do you think this new system might mean, while it'll advance some people, it might mean that some people are not going to get the raises they had planned on?
Well, I'm not positive about that, just because off the top of my head, I don't know what the exact law is for, what the increases are. So, I'm sure if the president, like the president mandated in his budget a increase for all civilian employees, they're still going to get that increase.
Yeah.
But, when it comes to these quality increases, that's a different story. I think it's also important to note, I wanted to bring this up, is that DOD is on a hiring freeze right now. So, trying to get into DOD is pretty tough also. There's some crazy personnel things going on right now.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier competing with Google and some of these other places for the best people. And I guess one of the big selling points the government's got, and this applies to people I know at Defense and CIA and places like that, is the mission itself. They love what they're doing, and they talk about supporting the troops. And that's as big a draw for most as pay.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And the leader of Cyber Command and the National Security Agency, Admiral Mike Rogers, that's one thing he always brings up whenever he's in Congress. These guys are cyber warriors, quote unquote, what they call them. And, they could go to Google and get paid six figures and, mm-hmm. Have the nice Google cars and everything. Yeah. But, they sit here and they come into the office and get paid less because they really care about the country. And that's something he brings up every time he
Good
talks
deal.
Almost.
Yeah. Scott, thank you very much for the briefing. Thank
Pleasure
you.
Pleasure
being
here.
We'll take a short break here. We'll be right back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm going to be talking with Nicole Ogrisco. She's covering a variety of things for Federal News Radio and of late been looking into the situation at the VA, which I guess is one of the most interesting, exciting, pummeled federal agencies around. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
What's going on here? What's the latest on this VA push to change the accountability procedures for its SES people?
The VA and both chambers of Congress are working on an omnibus bill that would change how the VA does a lot of things right now, and one of them is how it would hold its senior executives accountable. So the VA Secretary Bob McDonald officially submitted a proposal at the end of March to House Speaker Paul Ryan and President of the Senate Joe Biden, and in it, it describes a variety of different ways it would hold senior executives accountable. And the first is that it would put senior medical professionals under Title 38, which would change a lot of different things for them. And one of them is how they would be disciplined and appraised and paid altogether. And so this proposal essentially puts them under Title 38, and it says to them that the secretary ultimately has the authority to punish and discipline senior medical professionals. And what's interesting to me is that it would create what's called an internal evaluation board here, and that would be made up of a few members of a few VA senior medical professionals who would look at some of these cases. So for example, if the VA secretary wanted to fire or demote a senior medical professional and that SES member did not like that decision, he or she could take that decision to this board, and this board would review the evidence and review the case and make sure essentially that what the VA secretary did was fair and balanced, I guess you could say. And then ultimately the secretary would go back and review this decision, and then it sounds as if he would make another decision based on what the board said. So that's what we're hearing as far as the VA's proposal. Now it's unclear as to, you know, what provisions from the VA's proposal would make it into congressional legislation, but that's what the VA is proposing here.
Yeah, and so obviously the fact that VA is proposing this means the administration backs it. It had to go through OMB and clearly the White House.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's done. Now, this is in reaction to, I assume, the problem with the VA in Phoenix and a couple of other places where they were cooking the books and making it appear that patients didn't have a long wait when, in fact, they had waits of months or more, and the outcry from the public and the Congress. And so this could have been a lot worse for VA, couldn't it?
It could. And there are bills out there.
Yeah.
There's a bill called the VA Accountability Act from the House VA Committee Chairman Jeff Miller. And that essentially would give the VA secretary authority to discipline all VA employees. And there are a variety of different changes there under that bill that would really change all VA employees' appeal rights. And that's currently in the House. It passed the House. And the message that I'm hearing from the House VA committee is, hey, that's the bill and that's what it should be. And the Senate should take it up. And what are you waiting for? The Senate VA committee is taking a little bit of a different tone. They've expressed a desire to work specifically with the VA and with the administration, and it appears that's what they're doing. The Senate has said that they're going to come up with an omnibus bill in the next week or so that we should be hearing about. And the key thing that I'm hearing from both of these committees is that accountability is the key. So if they can't come to an agreement on what these accountability provisions will look like, I'm not sure what kind of progress they'll make on an entire bill altogether.
Again, it's a lame duck presidency, lame duck Congress, and so you always wonder about what, if anything, is going to happen. If it does happen, is it likely to stick in future years, or would a new administration, whether Republican or Democratic, come in with a totally different viewpoint? You get any sense of that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it might depend on, you know, if the balance changes in Congress, if at all, in the upcoming election. We do know that Jeff Miller, the chairman of the House VA committee, is retiring at the end of this congressional session. And so that could change. That could change a few things in how the committee goes about its business. But I'm not sure exactly what would carry sure. over into the next administration.
The VA is a huge agency. What's its third largest federal agency, something like that. So it's huge in that respect. But the implications for all federal workers or all federal executives, it's out there, isn't it? I mean, if they do this to VA and it seems to work, you could expect it in energy and defense and everywhere else, I would think.
I think that's the fear. And the House VA committee especially has indicated that the VA is sort of the test for a lot of different agencies. I think we saw that a little bit with different bills that the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee have put out in this congressional session. I believe a bill called the SES Accountability Act. It had different pieces of some of these bills that we're seeing from the VA, different accountability procedures especially, that appeared in different bills that would affect all federal employees. So yes, I do think that is the fear for many different agencies and associations that represent specifically senior executives. I think that's the fear there.
You were talking about this sort of peer review of medical personnel. So I guess that might be the way it works now on the outside for both the medical profession and the law profession, is you get this review of your peers.
Right. And the goal there is really to, I think, address the frustration with the Merit Systems Protection Board. MSPB overturned three punishments for senior executives at the VA within the past couple of months. And VA has said time and again that they're frustrated with how those decisions have gone, even though MSPB actually has ruled on the side of the agency the majority of the time.
Yeah, that's what was so surprising in three of these, because, yeah, if you go to the MSPB, you're usually toast if you're the accused. But in this case, and these were very serious charges, do you think the seriousness of the charges could be one reason that maybe MSPB looked at it a little bit harder and was a little more compassionate?
I think that's exactly why they came to the decision that they did. I think they said, if we had the authority to suggest a lesser punishment, then our decision might be different. But because of the way the VA Choice Act is written right now, they can essentially say yes or no.
Death penalty or freedom.
Right, yeah. Right. And so that's another reason why we're getting some of these alternatives, some of these other proposals to change the VA Choice Act right now.
Okay. You've written several VA pieces this month, and I noticed in one of them here, what was it? You said there were 21 different veterans bills have passed the House this year?
So not this year, but recently the House VA committee has passed these 21 bills, and they're the ones that they have suggested that they would like to include in the House VA committee's own version of an omnibus veterans package. So that's what they're really pushing. They're saying, we've done the work already.
Yeah.
We've passed these 21 bills. Where's the Senate? And the Senate has said that they're working on something.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but while this is the administration proposal, if you will, their way to cure it, the House and to some extent the Senate are pushing for other things that would be, I guess, more draconian on employees or the senior executives?
I would say the House, yes. I think it's unclear right now exactly what the Senate is pushing. I did attend a hearing with the Senate and the Senate VA committee, and VA Secretary Bob McDonald was there to present his proposal. And so it seems to me as if the Senate is willing to consider more of what the administration and what the VA would like to see. The House is really pushing for these more targeted bills for these VA employees.
Okay, we take a short break here. We'll be right back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Three, two, one. Hi, Mike Causey back here talking with Nicole Ogrisco. We've been talking about the situation of the VA, which is, I guess it's the third largest federal agency, if you don't count the Postal Service, and extremely important, especially since the scandals that happened a couple of years ago, and we're still feeling fallout from that. Weren't there some executives that were transferred or requested transfers? They went to cities closer to their home and they got better pay. How did that work out? Is that correct?
That's essentially correct. Basically, two senior executives, they were accused of abusing a relocation program or creating the appearance of that's what they wanted to do. And I think it was that they've requested to move to a different location and their responsibilities would actually be a little bit less than what they already had, what their current job was, but they would still make essentially the same amount or a little bit more and would also reap these benefits from moving at the same time. And so that's the, I guess you could say, scandal that we've heard so much about in the past couple of months.
Yeah. Well, this healthcare scandal, it mostly involves scheduling. But what that meant was that veterans, very needy veterans in some cases, weren't getting to see doctors for weeks, months. And yet the book showed that it was a prompt 24-hour service kind of thing. And on April 8th, I'm looking at here, you have a column that says VA pilots healthcare apps as new push for major reorganization emerges. You mean apps as in apps?
Yes. So the VA announced a few different tools that would help veterans essentially take more control of their own healthcare and how they actually schedule their own appointments. They're rolling out a few apps that veterans could use to schedule their own healthcare appointments. I think it's available in 10 places right now. The plan is to roll them out everywhere, I think, by early 2017. And it's all part of their push to just improve some of these services, just improve customer service. We've heard about this often from Secretary McDonald.
And what's the deal? And again, all I know is what I've read in our website and seen on TV. But they're talking about letting veterans just go to the doctor of their choice. If they can't get an appointment, just call a doctor close at hand and go to it. Where is that?
That's the debate that we're hearing right now, is what role exactly does VA healthcare play for veterans? So there are some veterans who, if they live a certain distance away from a VA medical center, they have a card and they can use that card to access healthcare in the private sector, and VA will ultimately, you know, pay for part of it at the end of the day. So the debate right now is, should VA continue to play this role in scheduling veterans' healthcare and providing its own healthcare? Or should we just say, here's a card for all veterans, mm-hmm. go out and find whatever you would like? And that's actually what we're seeing. This debate is appearing in a commission on care. So it's Congress actually mandated that this commission form. It's part of the VA Choice Act, which we've mentioned. And we're actually hearing that about 7 of the 15 members created what's called a straw man document, essentially proposing that VA kind of get out of providing healthcare and an expansion of more private sector community care options. And there's some other things in there that we can talk about too, but that's the debate that we're hearing.
Well, that's right. And back in the day, you'd have VA hospitals strategically located and people drove to them, but things have changed. And I guess it's the same rationale as when you talk about people who don't have health insurance, but in a sense they do, because they can go to an emergency room and they can't be turned away. And the argument is, better to give them health insurance than have them clogging up emergency rooms. And I know some years ago, one of the main things that the VA was dealing with, they were dealing with AIDS, HIV/AIDS, and diseases associated with smoking and drinking and that kind of thing. That group is dying out, and what they're going to be replaced by is, it's not unusual now for a service man or woman to have 5, 6, even 7 deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, and you're dealing with injuries that before would have killed you, and now you're injured for life, but you're alive, and also this post-traumatic stress, which is, I believe I saw a figure where it impacts up to 30% of the people. It's like we're wearing the military out by deploying them over and over again.
Sure. And I think the VA is trying to respond to shifting demographics and its veteran base and the kinds of health needs that veterans have today that maybe they didn't have before. And then also what veterans prefer, how they prefer to handle their own health care. So maybe you have a veteran who cannot schedule his or her own appointments, does need that help scheduling. But on the other hand, maybe you have a veteran who, for the most part, is able to control and able to schedule his own appointments and would like to do that, but is frustrated by the system that he has to go through with the VA right now to schedule those appointments. I think you're seeing kind of a shift in what veterans want and what they need, and the VA is trying to respond to that.
Yeah. You know, I'm just thinking ahead. You're talking about the straw man. I love that, and I can see why they use it. But if you did that, you'd turn the VA, and correct me if I'm wrong, you'd turn it into a kind of a scheduling operation, and they'd handle certain things. But if the vets had their own cards, they could do their own doctor planning and whatnot. What would happen to the VA medical people? They got tens of thousands of doctors and nurses.
So that's the big question. And this straw man proposal actually suggests closing a lot of VA medical facilities. The proposal doesn't say how many and doesn't suggest when exactly these closures would happen. It does suggest a rough timeline. But essentially, these professionals that are in VA medical facilities right now, it's unclear what would happen to them. The proposal does say, though, that with more with the demand going more toward VA care in the private sector, maybe those private sector companies could hire these former VA employees. I'm not sure exactly how that would work, but that is the suggestion that's included in the proposal. This would impact quite a few VA medical professionals that work in these hospitals now. I kind of compare it to BRAC, what DOD did, you know, to close different bases and things like that over a certain time. That's kind of what the straw man proposal is suggesting.
Yeah. I know some people have take a dim view of any professional that goes into the government, a lawyer, a doctor, that what have you. But the flip side of that is, and I've talked to both doctors and lawyers, things like malpractice insurance. You know, you don't need it in the government. And the idea of the hours are usually much better than they are in the private sector. So it is, for many people, it's not the place of last resort. It's a place they want to work, and they're very good at it.
Right. And I spoke with the American Federation of Government Employees, and something that I didn't think about that they pointed out to me was that the VA employs, I believe, about a third of its workforce are veterans.
Yeah.
And so that's a huge work base for veterans. And that's part of, obviously, the VA's role is to help the veteran adjust back to civilian life. And whether or not that means just receiving health care or getting a job or an education, that's the role that the VA is supposed to play right now. And her point was that if we're closing these VA medical facilities, you know, what will happen to those veterans' jobs? And that was her point that she made to me.
Yeah, if you go down to the VA headquarters on Vermont Avenue, you can just walk the halls and you can spot the military men and women. And they're literally standing tall and looking good, but a lot of them.
Right. Her point was, you know, this won't just affect doctors and nurses and other medical professionals, these senior executives that we spoke about, veterans that work in the cafeteria, that, you know, work in janitorial facilities, that might work in scheduling or administrative offices. Those jobs are, I guess, up in the air with this proposal.
Yeah. Well, we're in April already. There's going to be a lot of recesses this year for, you know, Congress is the one thing it does well is take vacations, and they've had a number already. They just got back from an extended Easter one. There's campaigning to be done. Some members haven't been in town in months. Do you think anything's going to happen this year on the federal employee front in any kind of legislation? I mean, no, it's always danger to say no, because they could, the last minute, rush to adjourn. They can pass something. But do you sense that? Because you're up on the Hill a lot.
I don't think that the proposal that we just talked about, the straw man, essentially, you know, to expand community care and take VA out of healthcare, I don't think, and I think the sense is that would not happen. Congress would not pass something like that. This administration would not let something like that happen. But both House and the Senate seem very intent on passing some sort of omnibus package. The timeline they keep referring to is Memorial Day. That would be an opportune time to put a bill like this on the president's desk. And part of that omnibus, they've made clear, will include some sort of accountability procedures, provisions in there that would affect senior executives. And so I do think that they're pretty intent on passing something and getting it done soon. Again, what it looks like and whether or not it veers more toward what the administration and what the VA would like, or more toward what we're hearing from the House VA committee, I think it's pretty unclear at this point.
Yeah, and this would be accountability for VA SES members, or would it be government-wide?
It would be for VA SES, although if the House has its way, it would veer more toward VA employees at large. But I think that from what we've seen from previous measures that have been out there and previous bills that have passed, it's more targeted toward those senior executives and not toward VA employees as a whole.
Okay, so you do think something's good. They're serious about this year?
Huh? I think they're serious about it this year.
Yeah, okay, real good. Nicole, we can't escape without talking money. sure. pay raise. The president has proposed, is it 1.6%?
1.6.
Okay, which is the largest raise he's proposed since he's been in office after 3 years of a pay freeze. In Congress, the proposal is for 5.3% pay raise. What about that? I mean, I guess we can kiss 5.3 goodbye, but who knows?
Who knows? I'm not sure. When the president proposed 1.6, the outcry was it's not enough. And I think we immediately heard from the first voice I think we heard about all of this that it wasn't enough was AFGE.
Yeah.
And the number they threw out there was 5.3%. And I think at the time, the first thought that many people had was, well, that's not going to happen. But then I believe it was Jerry Connolly, he put a bill out there, and it has quite a few sponsors at this point.
I think Senator Ben Carson too, didn't he?
Yes, there's a companion bill in the Senate for 5.3 pay raise the next fiscal year. So the sense is, okay, well, maybe. But I think the tricky thing right now is that there, as far as we know, at this point, the last count that we heard on this was that no Republican, either representative or senator, would sponsor this bill.
Not a good sign.
No. I think the last thing that we heard was, okay, well, maybe there might be some desire from a GOP representative or senator to get on this bill, but maybe they're holding back during the budget process. I think this is probably something that will play out toward the end of the fiscal year, of course, as we procrastinate and try to figure out, hammer down a final budget decision. So I'm not sure that we're going to hear anything on this much more.
You know, the other issue, too, here is federal retirees, postal and people who get Social Security. But as of now, they're in the hole. If anything were to happen, they would be in a negative because the cost of living is down from this time last year when it was down from this time before. But the retirees are going to wonder if federal workers got a 5.3% raise and the retirees got nothing, that could present some problems too.
You're right. Yeah, that could present some problems. And I think the other thing that we hear often is the rising cost of health insurance and health premiums that go up every year. And I think the argument out there is, okay, if you're raising our health insurance, but you know what's happening with cost of living adjustments and benefits for retirees. And yet at the same time, we're hearing this 5.3% pay raise idea, which is such a large number compared to the previous years and years without any raise at all.
Well, that makes me think of the Federal News Radio actually broke the story that long-term care insurance premiums are going up sometime this year. And the immediate reaction from people was, you know, woe is me, this is awful, they're going up. The real headline to me, the takeaway from this, is that only one company bid for the government's business. Mm. Out of there are 10 major insurance companies that offer long-term care insurance, and only one bid on it. And that tells you something. It's not a very lucrative business. People are living longer. They guessed incorrectly about how many people would drop it after a few years. They guessed wrong about the rising medical costs. So the lucky thing, really, instead of people complaining about it, is the fact that they can still get health insurance at a group rate, albeit it's going to cost more.
Sure. The Office of Personnel Management recently put out a few changes to the federal employee health benefits plan for the next fiscal year. They added a few other benefits. The big thing that they announced this year was benefits to cover care for autism. If your child has autism, different costs associated with caring for that have been included this year. The insurance providers are going to have to meet a few different new standards, a few different performance metrics that OPM will measure this year. So, yeah, I mean, I think your point is well taken there.
Nicole, thank you so much for being with us today. Thanks for being here on Your Turn. We'll see you next Wednesday. Have a good week.